Are American elections being hacked?
These elections are being manipulated and really leading to a coup, basically a rolling right-wing coup in America, which I think people are finally beginning to take notice of. Not only that it's a right-wing coup, but even people on the right, there's a feeling of an abridgment of public sovereignty, that people are not being represented, that the government is not governing with the consent of the governed. And we think a big, big part of that, from all the forensic evidence that we've gathered, has to do with the actual, very simple, direct manipulation or rigging of American elections inside the computers.
That's Jonathan Simon. We talked to him about the shocking vulnerability of our electronic voting machines and the evidence that that vulnerability is and has been exploited to flip elections. His book is Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century. Then there is one way to make sure your voting machines aren't being hacked, and it's being used by one county in New York State.
What works for us, what gives us the transparency that we need to feel very comfortable about the results that we certified, taking the ballots, hand counting them with teams of Republicans and Democrats, working very carefully, and coming up with the results based on that.
That's Board of Elections Commissioner Virginia Martin. She'll tell us how and why they hand count the vote in her county. It ain't hard, and it ain't expensive. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Remember when Karl Rove was visibly shocked by, indeed refused for a long while to accept, the Ohio election results of 2012 that put Barack Obama over the top in winning the election? Did you know that the machines counting the vote in Ohio were largely owned by the Romney family? And that some experts suspect those machines were prepped to rig the election for Romney. So why didn't that happen? The answer isn't because the machines weren't rigged. No, the answer you'll hear later will surprise you. There's virtual unanimity among the experts who have studied electronic voting machines that insiders or hackers can change the results of elections without leaving a trace, at least not the kind of trace that any election administrator is likely to find. These studies have come from institutions like Johns Hopkins, Princeton, University of Michigan, the Brennan Center for Social Justice at NYU, the states of California and Ohio, and even the U.S. Government Accountability Office. In his book Code Red, Jonathan Simon argues it's all part of a plan first put into play with the passage of the Help America Vote Act of 2002, a truly Orwellian name for the legislation if what he says is true, our elections are being rigged. And why not? The stakes are enormous, nothing less than world power, prestige, and wealth. The machines are black boxes, designed, run, and read by private corporations with proprietary control. We, the people, pay for them, but we have no access to them. And most voting machine companies are highly partisan from the right wing of the political spectrum. Could it be this that underlies the massive shift to the right in elections, in spite of the overwhelming unpopularity of the Republican Congress and Republican legislators in states when Americans are polled? Jonathan Simon is a member of the Bar of Massachusetts. He was a political survey research analyst, and in 2004 he became an early advocate for exit polls to detect computerized vote shifting in the presidential election that year. He's the co-founder and director of the Election Defense Alliance. Well, Jonathan Simon, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's great to be here.
Now, you wrote the book Code Red, which is, well, first tell us about the title. What does Code Red refer to?
Well, Code Red, you know, it sounds like some sort of emergency, and that's what this is. But apart from that, there's code inside voting machines, voting computers. And our analysis, all our data gathering and analysis over the past 15 years indicates that a lot of that code is vulnerable to manipulation, both by insiders and hackers. And the direction of that manipulation has been almost always, it's unilateral, and it's what we call a red shift, because the Republican or more right-wing candidates do better in the vote counts than they do in exit polls, they do in any other measure. So we suspect that inside of the machines, the manipulation that's going on is intentional. It's not just glitches. And it's taking, if you want to call it blue code or regular white code, and turning it red, just, you know, as it's a metaphor for the fact that these elections are being manipulated and really leading to a coup, basically a rolling right-wing coup in America, which I think people are finally beginning to take notice of. Not only that it's a right-wing coup, but even people on the right, there's a feeling of an abridgment of public sovereignty, that people are not being represented, that the government is not governing with the consent of the governed. And we think a big, big part of that, from all the forensic evidence that we've gathered, has to do with the actual, very simple, direct manipulation or rigging of American elections inside the computers.
Inside the computers, is that the only way that elections are rigged?
It depends on how you use the term rig. There are a lot of strategies and schemes that have always been used to alter or influence the outcome of elections. I mean, for many years, it was very retail. It was ballot box stuffing, dead people voting twice, ballots being thrown out. So there have always been methods, and that's because elections are very, very high-stakes games. They are for all the marbles. I mean, you control the government and the direction of a state or of a country, there's a lot in that for people, both in terms of financial reward and in terms of power and influence. So they're very vulnerable targets. But what's happened with the introduction and the proliferation of computerized vote counting is it's become possible and actually quite easy to do it wholesale, to target elections, to change the results of not just one election, but dozens, hundreds of elections from the inside through the programming process. And so it's made a very vulnerable target, and it's made a very, very high reward-to-risk ratio. The reward is tremendous. The manipulations are essentially undetectable under the system that we have now of counting votes and verifying the counts. So you wind up with a huge reward-to-risk ratio that gives every incentive to those who would be bad actors to go ahead and do it.
So when did this start, and how did this happen?
Well, election rigging of the computer age basically came about with the proliferation of computers as vote counting and vote recording instruments. And that was basically the turn of the century. There was punch cards before that. There was lever machines. But it did not become optical scanner and touchscreen machines that are such easy targets until about 2002, when in the aftermath of the 2000 election, the debacle of the hanging chads, that was exploited brilliantly by those who had already had it a plan afoot to computerize American elections. So one kind of has to ask what the hanging chads were all about. There was evidence of sabotage in the 2000 election. That's kind of a side story, but it set it up for the Help America Vote Act, HAVA, which was passed shortly after the 2000 election and has basically used carrot and stick to induce the states across the country very rapidly at that point to computerize their elections and either get these touchscreen machines or optical scanners, which are also computers, they're both computers, to count our votes. And so since the 2002 election, we've been looking at anywhere from 80 to now probably about 97, 98% of our votes being counted electronically in the pitch dark of cyberspace.
So explain a little bit more why and how they are so easy to rig. For example, you have in your book, Code Red, you have the example of how you can start at minus 50 on one side and plus 50 on another. Now, I have to tell you, I am mathematically challenged, although I did get this example. But I'm going to be a stand-in for all those mathematically challenged listeners also. So try to tell us in the simplest terms possible.
Well, that's actually what I try to do in Code Red. I try to make it accessible and readable. Because if you just give a lot of mathematical equations and statistics, the eyes glaze over and the book falls down. So that was one example that I used, and it was one of the most straightforward examples of how you would rig an election. And what it relies on the fact that computers don't know what zero is. You know, if you're counting ballots by hand and you put one ballot down on the table, you know that the table is zero and the first ballot is one and the second ballot is two. But inside a computer, you can set zero to anything, the where the count begins. So in an optical scan computer, for instance, there are anywhere from about 500,000 to 700,000 lines of code on the memory card that controls the count inside that computer. Visualizes the ballots, figures out where the marks are, and begins to add the votes for all the races on the ballot. Interpolating three lines of code into those 500 to 700,000 lines of code, you can alter the zero counter. So, for instance, if you have candidate X and candidate Y, and you set candidate X's zero counters to plus 50, candidate Y's zero counters to minus 50, then the first ballot that comes in for candidate X will be number 51. The first ballot that comes in for candidate Y will be number minus 49 or negative 49. At the end of the day, if there have been 500 ballots cast in actuality for each candidate, candidate X will show 550, candidate Y will show 450. The sum total of those ballots is 1,000. There will be 1,000 voters that signed the poll books. So the election administrator looks at it and says, 1,000 equals 1,000. We have a clean election, and you've just shifted a net of 100 votes. And that's just the simplest of rigs. It's virtually undetectable, even if you had access to that memory card. But the joke is, we don't have access to the memory card. We don't have access to any of the ballots that are stored in that optical scanner. We don't have access to the code that goes into programming those computers. And when I say we, I mean the public, I mean the candidates, I mean the election administrators. The only ones with access are the corporations that do the programming and deployment of these machines and their programming, the hardware and the software. And we've basically turned over the entire vote counting process of the United States to a very small handful of privatized and quite secretive corporations. We know, remember Diebold from the 2004 election. It's now Dominion, ES&S, Hart InterCivic, Sequoia. Again, corporations that are private, they can be pursuing their own private agenda, and from what we've also researched, have very, very strong partisan affiliation. And guess what? It's to the right wing.
Well, let me ask you a question. I want to get back to those machines, but before we do, I was a poll worker in Suffolk County in the April 19th primary, and I won't go into all the problems. That's for another day, but we did have the OptiScan ballots, and those are paper ballots that are marked by hand, and then they're scanned in, and they go into the machine, and at the end of the day, those ballots are locked in the machine, and they're supposed to be kept for 2 years. I spoke with Board of Elections officials of Suffolk County a week later when I went to witness the count of the provisional ballots. And they said that all the ballots are kept for 2 years. No one said that they couldn't have access to them. I mean, my impression was their evidence are kept for 2 years in case you want to do a hand count. Am I wrong in that assumption?
Federal ballots actually have to be kept for 22 months, close to 2 years. We've seen that observed in the breach when they wanted to do a recount in Ohio and they were under court order to maintain the ballots. I believe that two-thirds of the counties, and I don't have the exact numbers, but about two-thirds of the counties had already destroyed the ballots. And that was the Bush versus Kerry race that was so controversial, and there was every reason in the world to examine those ballots. In the real world, in the world of practicality, those ballots never see the light of day. If you went and asked for the access to the ballots, you would be told you have no right to have access to the ballots. If a candidate went and asked for access to the ballot, then he or she would be told they have no right to access to those ballots. Under very specific circumstances, in many cases, there's a very, very narrow margin of an election that would trigger a recount. Under those circumstances, those ballots might see the light of day, but you'll virtually never see it happen. One reason is the margin is so small. If you're talking about 0.5% statewide, if you're rigging a race and you know that the margin that triggers the recount is 0.5%, you're going to rig it past that margin. I mean, if you can rig it to 50.1% to 49.9%, you can certainly rig it to 50.6% to 49.4% and avoid triggering the recount. As far as candidate, and it varies very much from state to state, but as far as candidate recounts, where the candidate comes in and requests a recount, the fees for those recounts are made so prohibitive. And if you think about it, it's after the election. Most candidates do whatever they can to win that election. That includes spending all their money and going into debt in advance of the election. So now you're post-election and you're asking a candidate to come up with another $1 million or $2 million to recount. In addition to the fact that the candidate who makes that request is going to be labeled and pilloried as a sore loser, and their political career will be in serious jeopardy at that point. We've been in touch with many candidates who we felt the electoral results were highly suspect. I mean, John Kerry just being, you know, prima inter pares. And the reaction is always, we can't do this. We can't do this. This is political death to challenge the electoral system and say, I think there was a miscount. So when you add up all the various factors and prohibitions and inhibitions, the reality is that you will not see those ballots in that op scan, which give people the false assurance that there is paper ballots and that this is somehow better than the touchscreen machines, which it is mildly better. The ballots do exist. But in the real world, we're not seeing them counted. We haven't been seeing them counted for Bernie Sanders, and there's every reason to suspect that there's been electronic rigging going on in the whole series of 2016 primaries, not a single recount of those ballots. So that's, in our view, is false, completely false assurance.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking about the rigging of American elections, how the system lends itself so easily to the manipulation of the vote. Our guest is Jonathan Simon. He's the author of Code Red. So talk a little bit now about the companies that make these machines and how they have become so involved in the political process itself.
Well, you have the companies that make the machines, and you have their satellites, even more mysterious companies, that actually are often involved in the programming and distribution process. And they're involved in the political process in a, how should I put it? I mean, certainly not in a formal designated way. They're involved because they're basically have control of the vote counting process. Ideally, this would be a public trust. These are public elections. Those are the public's ballots. It's been outsourced. Why has it been outsourced? Well, based on what we've seen, one of the reasons it's been outsourced is that it makes it extremely easy to control the political direction and leadership of the United States. But one of the reasons why it's been so readily outsourced is that in our age, we're all for speed and we're all for convenience and we want things done for us and we want them done quickly and we want our answers to, you know, who won this election by 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night before we go to bed. And for that, we're willing to pay the price of complete vulnerability, complete insecurity. We're basically ready to put the nation and its future and the future of the world, on which it has such influence, right there out on a silver platter for bad actors of all stripes to take a bite and change and alter the course of history. The companies themselves, I mean, they're very hard to get information about. If you go on their website, you'll see the standard slick stuff about how wonderful they are and, you know, how much control they have over the various, territories of regions of voting and whatnot. But you're not going to see much about the inner workings of the machine. You're not going to see anything, really. It's corporate puffery. And there's no investigation. I mean, not only into companies like Dominion and ES&S and Diebold when it was in business for this, but, you know, it takes fringe investigators, people out on the lunatic fringe, to even look into a company like Hart InterCivic and find out that it was largely owned by the Romney family. And they were counting the votes in Ohio on Hart InterCivic machines in 2012. And so, you know, they're very difficult to penetrate and investigate. We do know that the heads of operational heads back in 2004 and in that era of Diebold and then later become Premier Election Systems and ES&S respectively were two brothers named Bob and Todd Yurosevich. And they were right-wing affiliated. They had a family fortune, and they decided to pile it into voting machines. Now, voting machines are notoriously non-profitable enterprises. They could have gone into soda machines or slot machines and made a lot more money, but they just decided, as it turned out, to go into voting machines and took over Diebold, took over ES&S operationally. You have to start questioning those motives. Then you have, you know, local organizations like LHS and Triad and Command Central that operate regionally or in certain states, and it's almost impossible to find out anything about them at all. They don't even have websites in most cases. And they're the ones that are actually doing the programming of these machines. And you can imagine that the access there is not very difficult to get on the part of a Karl Rove or somebody, you know, with an interest and an agenda into getting into the inside on these. And that leaves out of account all the possibilities for hacking as well, even from outside our borders. I mean, these machines are very often networked now, which means that, you know, we know you can break into any computer network. I mean, even ones that have, you know, layers and layers and layers of security, the Pentagon, the IMF, have been broken into, big corporations, Visa, MasterCard, et cetera, et cetera. These machines have virtually no security when they're networked, so it is child's play to break in, and so we could be looking at a vulnerability to manipulation of our elections by those in other countries. For instance, China has an interest in our elections. Personally, I don't think that's the primary danger. I think the primary danger is domestic. I think it comes from the inside. I think it does not take an enormous operation to do, because once you have the access, the actual technical part of altering memory cards or setting up servers that process the votes in real time and alter vote counts is actually not a very difficult project.
So, talk about 2012 then. 2012 was an election that Barack Obama actually won again, and it was instructive to see the utter shock on the face of Karl Rove and George Romney, which at the time, you know, I didn't have any sense of why they were so shocked, other than perhaps their own hubris. But after reading Code Red, I thought, well, they were so shocked because they were sure they'd stolen it fair and square.
Yeah, I think you're dating yourself. It was Mitt Romney, and George Romney was
I meant Mitt Romney.
Yeah, Mitt Romney, and very much so in the case of Karl Rove. I mean, here he was on Fox News. He was the star attraction for the night. He was there with other heavy hitters from the right wing. Fox News calls Ohio and the U.S. election for Barack Obama, and Karl Rove comes right out and says, wait a minute, what are you doing? You're not paying attention to the latest numbers, which I have, which are showing a big shift. You know, and I'm paraphrasing what he said, but it's out there on public record. And Karl Rove is an extremely shrewd and disciplined man. It's not in his nature to just court public humiliation in that way. So it was a very odd thing, and it struck a lot of us at the time. The inside story of what happened is actually that there was a group, Anonymous, which we know of from other infiltrations that they've made, that were able to get in and actually alter and block Rove's button pushers, his implementers, access to their own website. He had a set of servers that were under the name of Orca. And it was ostensibly put forward as a get-out-the-vote operation, but it really had access to the stream, live stream in real time, of the vote counts from states like Ohio, these critical swing states. And the idea was, as they did in 2004, to intercept and alter those vote counts and then send them back into the state election board's servers having altered the count of the votes. And when Karl Rove's button pushers, I call them, went to try to do this, they were locked out of their own website because Anonymous had managed to infiltrate and alter the passwords. And Karl Rove was not aware of this at the time he gave this very, very odd speech on Fox News saying, "What are you? How come you're calling this race so prematurely?" It seemed pretty obvious in retrospect that he was expecting an alteration in the vote counts, which never happened. It didn't happen because his real-time rigging apparatus had been disabled.
So we can thank Anonymous for actually saving the integrity of the 2012 election.
Yeah, we can thank him for saving the integrity of the 2012 election. And there was another story regarding 2008 as well. Both of Obama's victories have asterisks on them. I'm not sure we can thank them for saving the integrity of our electoral system, however, because, of course, every time, you know, Obama won an election, the interest in election integrity plummeted. I mean, the concern about election rigging was very one-sided. It was that races were being rigged for George Bush, and what got much less play, but actually was much more important, was all the down-ballot races for Senate, for House, for state legislature. The political infrastructure of America has been altered, and in many cases indelibly altered, or certainly for a long time. It's a very enduring strata in the political structure of America, the U.S. House, the state houses. And if we look at how they've turned, it's completely, completely out of sync with American public opinion. And I can go into that a little bit more later. But the bottom line is that when Obama won election, people looked at it and said, oh, well, the system must be fine. So in a way, Anonymous, by saving the one ship, lost the convoy. It has taken a lot of attention away, a lot of whatever wind there was in the sails of those who were calling for an observable vote counting system, who were calling for a serious investigation of our vote counting system. You know, well, Obama won. And, you know, you can see it throughout the left. I mean, they're extremely complacent about elections, even though as a matter of governmental representation, I mean, their agendas are mostly, if you exempt gay rights and transsexual rights, and their agendas are basically dead on arrival. And they're just sort of accepting this. And one reason is that we have an African-American, quote-unquote, you know, left-winger in the White House. And people look at that and they say, well, all's right with the world. And this is extremely misleading. And it doesn't speak to what has been done in 2006, 2010, 2014, and even the presidential elections, if you look down the ballot at what's been happening. And we'll go into 2014. We went into that election with a congressional approval rating for the Republican majority in Congress in the single digits. Some had it as low as 6%. You know, do you approve of the job Congress is doing? Yes was 6% or 7% or 8%. No was 89%. I mean, this is off the charts. Adolf Hitler could get a better approval rating than the American Congress and the Republican majority going into 2014. So you had 222 Republican incumbents in the U.S. House of Representatives standing election in 2014 with an approval rating, a congressional approval rating in the single digits, with for the first time in history a plurality of people saying their own representative didn't deserve reelection. And how many of those 222 lost their seats? I mean, you would think it would be a throw the bums out, big turnover election. I mean, Obama's approval rating was 45%. The Congress's approval rating was 8% or 6% or 9%, depending on who was doing the poll. Well, two out of 222 Republican incumbents lost their seats in 2014. So you have these elections in which it doesn't sync at all with any other measure of the voting public. And of course, the answer would be, well, the Democrats didn't turn out. Well, if the Democrats didn't turn out, how did all these highly progressive ballot propositions pass in all of these states by wide, wide margins, by margins that are so wide that they couldn't have been rigged without failing the smell test by 30%. Marijuana, minimum wage, environmental, all these ballot propositions. Well, where were the voters to support those if they didn't turn out? But as John Nichols, writing for The Nation, said, These voters just didn't elect Democrats. And that's as simple as that. We're just going to say, okay, that's what happened. You got a system where you have virtually zero ability to verify, zero accountability. We don't know what's in those computers. We don't know what kind of code is on those memory cards or in these servers to which the votes are being sent and then sent back. It's completely a black box system. It is as vulnerable as any system could be imagined to be. We get these results. We produce this evidence of just these anomalies doesn't even begin to do justice to what we keep seeing. And it's not just one election. It's pervasive over and over and over again. And the answer from not the right wing, but from the left wing and from the entire media is, we're not interested. You're conspiracy theorists.
Jonathan Simon. We'll talk more about rigging electronic voting machines and how to restore election integrity after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking about how our electronic voting machines are being used to rig elections. Our guest is Jonathan Simon. His book is Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century. Before the break, we were talking about the reluctance of not only the corporate, but also the progressive media to entertain the possibility that our elections are being rigged.
Why do you think that's so?
That is the 64-bit question. There are a bunch of theories about that, about, you know, how the left has, whether it's Stockholm syndrome, you know, where you're just sort of knuckling under to your oppressor, whether it's they have their own fiefdoms to protect. My personal theory, and it's just a personal theory, is that the elites somewhere deep down, and this is the elites of the left as well as the right, have something like a subconscious contempt for the public sovereignty, per se. You look out at the voting public, and you're a Harvard-educated, you know, writer for The Nation or writer for The New York Times or political staffer, and you look out at the public and you say, my God, this is, you know, millions of people here. The vast majority of them follow the Kardashians. They're all fascinated by football and NASCAR. I mean, the public sovereignty comes down to individuals. And when we look at the mass of individuals and we look at, you know, who they are, do we really have a great deal of trust in their ability to make decisions, make these electoral decisions? And, you know, that goes back to a very old split and schism in the American body politic between Alexander Hamilton on the one side and Thomas Jefferson on the other. And the Hamiltonians were basically the elitists of their day saying, wait, you know, restrict the franchise, make sure people have property so they, you know, they'll know what they're doing. Make sure they're educated, make sure they're men, make sure they're white. The Jeffersonians were more along the lines of, let's open the franchise. It was, sort of an agrarian democracy ideal, and let's trust the people. Now, there was a fair amount of hypocrisy in that, personal and otherwise, but those were the polls. And, you know, over time, the Hamiltonians have basically won out. And in our age, we are very much being controlled, and the information flow in our age is either being controlled or the attempt is being made to control it by the elites. And, you know, I don't think it takes a wild-eyed, rebellious, Ruby Ridge survivalist conspiracy theorist to see this. Now, fortunately, there's been the internet. But you look at something like the internet, and that, you know, it, in a way, it makes our case because it was created to be a free flow of information. And what we're seeing more and more is toll gates go up, and net neutrality is something that is very much endangered. You know, it takes a huge fight just to maintain that. So, you know, to the point where the elites once again gain control of the mode of communication, the mode of passage of information. You know, when somebody like Eric Snowden comes out and starts, you know, or WikiLeaks and leaking all this information, I mean, the hammer of the state comes down on them hard because they are really, in many ways, the most dangerous people out there are people with information, not people with guns or people with bombs, but people with information. And, you know, among the elites, I think the motivation, the fire in the belly to protect the franchise and protect the sovereignty of the American public is probably not very great. But that having been said, And to answer the original question, I think there are probably many different reasons, but institutionally speaking, that not only the mainstream media, but to a large extent the progressive media, this has been an untouchable subject. I mean, it's right up there with 9/11. It's right up there with the JFK assassination. In many cases, more difficult, especially considering the amount of evidence that has been produced that says we're not sure who's committing this crime, but there is a dead body. We do have a corpus delicti. We have all these elections where you're getting these results that whether you look at it relative to the exit polls or you do something that we use called cumulative vote share analysis or you look at individual anecdotes or you see votes flipping on touchscreen machines, poll watcher reports, all these things that are all very, very strongly probative that something very significant, targeted, and directional is taking place, and there's no interest in taking any further step in reporting it or investigating it. And that, to me, these are the real villains of the piece. You know, in certain ways, you could say who's ever rigging, they're bad actors. In a way, they're doing the job that bad actors are created to do. They're bad actors. They're acting badly. But where is the excuse for the media in this country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there's also another reason, because I can feel that other reason so much in myself. And that is, voting, the right to vote, is such a fundamental aspect of our definition as Americans. Democracy, one person, one vote, even though we don't really have all that because we have an electoral system, that the idea that the vote is rigged is so profoundly disturbing. And that is what has happened to me since the April 19th primary, when I just saw the mayhem and the chaos that occurred. It has been a deeply disturbing psychological process for me to come to terms. I'm in a constant state of shock that, no, our elections are not fair. So now I'm going to ask you, John Simon, I'm going to ask you, what can we do about it?
Well, before I go to that, I'll just share your grief and shock. And yes, you're right. That's probably a big part of it. We are America. We are the beacon of democracy. This is our identity. This is what's left of our self-esteem, is we do democracy right. We were the first democracy. We're the best democracy. How can you take this away, this fundamental piece of our self-esteem? And I tell you, after 15 or 16 years of doing this work, I still wake up every now and then with what I call the nah reflex. Nah, there must be some benign explanation. You know, all this evidence, yeah, it just can't be. So I totally get that. And you see that in the public. You certainly see that the closer you get to the seat of power and influence, the more you're part of that, where your job and your identity is dependent on the integrity of the political system. So as you go up the political scale, as you go up the journalistic scale, as you say, even more so. So that's true. That's a huge part of it. And it's obviously, as well, I mean, the real mastery of a manipulator of something like, you know, on this scale of the United States electoral system, is really not in the technical know-how. It's really in the psychological ability to gauge how much you can get away with before people stop saying nah and they start saying, wait a minute, let's check the air pressure in those footballs. We think Tom Brady's up to something. But you're right, you can check the air pressure in footballs without destroying millions of people's sense of their own identity. I mean, the Tour de France can be rigged and people can say, I'm going to point over there and that's Lance Armstrong or that's A-Rod, you know. That's somebody taking steroids. That's easy. But this is us. This is our whole system, and it's what we believe in. It's what ideally should bring us together as a country. So people just don't want to see it, and I don't want to see it, and you don't want to see it. And so you're up against that to begin with. What we need to do at this point, I believe we've gathered enough evidence. We've gathered more than enough data, and we've done more than enough analysis. My colleagues and I have been at this for years, year in, year out, and it's on the record. It's out there for anybody who wants to look at it. I mean, Code Red, computerized election theft in the new American century. It's in that book, as well as other books. And it's there, it's presented in that book in a way that people can access it. It's not some strange PhD thesis with logarithms hanging out the sleeves, you know? It's simple, it's pretty straightforward, it's pretty persuasive. So that's out there. What we need now, we're not winning in court. We're not getting legislative action. We're not, the media is mocking. Even in light of an election like 2016, which has so much wrong with it, they're still mocking. We need to turn to the public, and it's time for the public to step up and reclaim its sovereignty. And that means, as it did for the movement for civil rights, as it did for the movement for women's rights, as it did for the movement for gay rights, as it did for the movement for peace, anti-nuclear, it means civil disobedience. It means getting out there and saying, and I'm sorry, you know, those are our fucking ballots. We have the right and we have the duty as citizens to participate in the count of those ballots for that count to be observable. You know, David Ortiz, great Boston Red Sox baseball player, after the Marathon bombing, is giving a speech, and he came out and he said, "This is our fucking city." And it galvanized the whole city, and it galvanized much of the country, because somebody right from his heart was saying the obvious, this is our place, this is our country. There was that sense of putting it together in a fist. When they raised their fist at the 1968 Olympics, how brave was that to stand on that podium and those two black athletes with their black gloves on, knowing that their medals were going to be stripped, knowing that their endorsements were going to be gone, knowing that they were going to be vilified. They knew that. And they stood up during a time when there was racial prejudice, racial segregation, Vietnam, and a time when the people were beginning to say no to this military-industrial complex. And they stood up and they raised their fist on that podium and bowed their head when the American national anthem was being played. That's courage. That's bravery. So what we need to do needs to be focal, it needs to be local, and it needs to be immediately recognizable as something that is fair and just and necessary. And what that translates to, in my view, is what I call op-scan parties. Where there are records of the vote, where those are our ballots, and we have made the marks on those ballots, and they've dropped down to the bottom of the op scan machine. At the close of voting, you have a dozen voters who are brave enough to spend the night in jail, perhaps, or get a little bit of blowback for what they're doing. Form a circle around that op scan down at their precinct and say, "We're not moving. We want that op scan open, the ballots taken out, and a publicly observable hand count initiated. This is our right. This is our duty." Now, you bring in a few celebrities like Tim Robbins, who has already shown a great interest in this area. You bring in a few dozen. There are many out there, many A-listers who they don't consider it their first responsibility, but they're very distressed about what is going on in this country. And you bring them in so you have the coverage. The media is essentially forced to cover those as opposed to making it disappear. And you stage them around the country, maybe in 100 different places, 200, 300 if you can. So it becomes a signal moment and a signal event, like the lunch counter protest, like the school bus protest, like standing at the nuclear, at Seabrook, at a nuclear plant, and saying, "This is where the rubber meets the road. Those are our ballots. They don't belong to Dominion. They don't belong to ES&S. They're not corporate," which is how they're now regarded. The memory card, the code, the ballots, it's all corporate property. And that's ridiculous. Those are our ballots. And that's what I think needs to be done. The public needs to start converting its suspicions into action and saying what we want. We're not looking to undo, redo the 2004 election, the 2014 election, any election. What we want is prospective. Going forward, we want an observable vote counting system so that elections in America can actually be trusted. And right now, they're not, and we see what the consequences are. There is this great disconnect between the public and its government. If that goes far enough, you wind up in one of two places. You wind up with a Stalinist regime like in Soviet Union, where everybody knows it's corrupt, but everybody knows that they have no power to do anything about it. So you get complete resignation from any form of public life participation. Or you get France, 1789. You get the guillotine, and you get a major revolution. I don't think we want either of those. What we need, in effect, is a preemptive revolution in the counting of our vote. Very simple, very doable, very nonviolent, to stave off this increasing loss of sovereignty and the bad results of which we're just beginning to see the tip of the iceberg now.
That's very powerful. I just want to ask one more thing, and that is about this election, because it really does seem that Bernie Sanders has sparked a movement. It's more than an election, it's a movement. But he's calling for a political revolution, which is about the ballot box. Do you see any point in people voting before we can achieve the kind of changes that we do through civil disobedience?
That's really an excellent question. I mean, I've often felt when I go to cast my own vote that I should not be voting. I mean, after all, I'm, you know, professionally involved in bringing out precisely how illegitimate and untrustworthy our voting and vote counting systems are. And, you know, it's often struck me as very odd. And I know that when I go in to cast a ballot, I don't do it with a sense of national pride and joy. I do it with a sense of deep, ironic frustration and resignation. It's a very negative experience for me, and disempowerment because of the evidence that I've gleaned over all these, you know, years that says this is whatever is happening to my vote is not the issue. It's what's happening in the aggregate to the votes. So I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. I think there are many states in which, at least for the presidential election, one is free to vote one's heart. One can vote for Jill Stein. One can vote, do a write-in ballot. So in the presidential general election, in all but six or seven swing states, there's a lot of latitude there. In the primaries, I mean, I was talking to somebody in California. You know, California just canceled their exit polls. You know, you don't like the message, shoot the messenger. And
say why that's important.
Well, we've been using exit polls as a baseline to try to assess what the validity of the vote counts are. And of course, you know, the poobahs will basically say, well, you can't use exit polls that way. And they weren't designed to be used that way. And I was like, well, yeah, they were, number one. And number two is, if they weren't, why weren't they? Why are you putting something into the design so that we can't use them to make parallel count to the vote counts? So, I mean, they've been coming out election after election in this primary season on the Democratic side, in the Democratic primaries, shifted. They've all been shifted with two very notable exceptions, from Bernie Sanders to Hillary Clinton, by large margins, outside the margin of error in so many of these states. And remember, you know, a state doesn't have to be close in the primaries to be a target for rigging, because they're not winner-take-all, the vast majority of them. It's about the apportioning of delegates. So even if a state like Mississippi or Alabama or something is 70-30, there's still delegates at stake. The difference between 65-35 and 70-30 is very significant. As a matter of fact, I mean, if you look at the shifts that we've seen in 2016, and you take them into account as being manipulated, that Bernie Sanders would be the nominee already before California. So, you know, he was the only dangerous candidate in the field. We've seen a huge dump of a very, very, very red flag data. And I'll give you one more thing along those lines. The only major state to be shifted from the other way around, from Clinton to Sanders, between the exit polls and the vote counts, was Oklahoma. And you'd say, well, of course, you know, and there's going to be one outlier in any crowd, until you learn that Oklahoma is also the only state in which the state, rather than the vendors, does the programming of the computers. And when you look at that, little coincidence, that of all those states, the only state in which there's no access through the vendors to the rigging of the election, turns out to be one where the exit polls were not only just – they weren't just accurate. They went the other way. Mm-hmm. And you say to yourself, well, why was that? If there was no rigging, if we're presuming there was no rigging in Oklahoma, why weren't the exit polls accurate? Well, it does suggest that in all these other elections, all these other primaries, exit pollsters are fanatical about error review, about looking over where they've gone wrong and tweaking and fixing. And it's quite plausible that what they've been doing is tweaking it, tweaking that sample, tweaking the weighting in Hillary's advantage. When, not because of any nefarious motive, but just to try to get these elections right, because they saw the pattern. They saw that they were always off in the other direction. So, you know, what Oklahoma shows is that if they did that and then the election itself wasn't rigged, it backfired and they got caught with their pants down because the election wasn't rigged and they had built in a tweak into the vote, to the exit polls to anticipate the rig. And then it wasn't rigged because there was no access to rigging it. And so that tells you that all those other states, the red shift or the shift from Sanders to Clinton was probably even greater than these huge numbers that we saw. And, you know, what you're winding up watching, in all likelihood, I mean, the evidence points really strongly. You're watching a candidate being stopped through many means. Some of it's more overt and involves voter registration cancellations, which I believe you saw that. Many people have seen that. That's at least overt. The voter can say, whoa, what happened? You know, there's the chance of discovery. When it's the actual count inside the machines, you know, or if you deposit a $1,000 check in your bank account and it doesn't show up in your bank statement, you're going to have a lot of angry depositors. That doesn't happen with the vote counts. Nobody knows what happened to their vote or anybody else's vote. But what we're seeing is you're seeing these overt means of disenfranchisement, and you're seeing these covert means of shifting these votes electronically to stop somebody who has generated a tremendous amount of public support, surprisingly, because he's articulating the concerns of a good part of what is now an unrepresented public. And you're seeing the same thing in many ways on the Republican side with Donald Trump. You know, a lot of angry people, a lot of frustrated people. This is what happens when the public begins to lose its sovereignty.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jonathan Simon, for talking with us here about this absolutely vital topic. Your book is Code Red. Thanks for talking with Writer's Voice.
Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century. Thank you, Francesca, for your interest, your concern, and I can also tell your outrage. It's time we fix this problem.
Find links to Jonathan Simon's website, also named Code Red, and to the Election Defense Alliance, which he co-founded and directs. If you want to ensure the integrity of elections, there is one tried and true method: hand counting the ballots, every ballot, and doing it publicly with all the parties involved. That's what happens in one New York State county, Columbia County. I met Democratic Board of Elections Commissioner Virginia Martin at a panel presentation she gave about how elections are run in her county. She agreed to tell our listeners when I called her at her office. Virginia Martin, Democratic Election Commissioner in Columbia County, New York. Welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Now, I first heard you speak at a panel on election integrity, and you described what is basically a unique system in New York State for conducting elections. Tell us what system you have adopted in Columbia County.
It does indeed seem to be unique in New York State. What we do is we essentially hand count all of the optically scanned ballots from every election. After every election is over, we are very, very careful about the chain of custody of our ballots. And so what we do is we base our election results on the hand count of all of the ballots that were scanned, and also, of course, the absentee and affidavit ballots. And everything gets hand counted. And the results that we certify are based on that hand count. Our hand count is open to the public. It's very transparent. You know, it's very safe and secure. We feel very confident about it. And it's supported by not only myself, but, of course, my Republican counterpart. Together, he and I, Jason Naske and I, make up the Board of Elections in Columbia County.
Now, tell us how large Columbia County is, or how many voters, roughly.
We have about 40,000 voters.
So does that make it easier or harder? I mean, it's pretty small compared to, let's say, Brooklyn, which lost 160,000 voters from its rolls. And, of course, many, many more votes were counted. What do you say to people who say, well, you can do that because you're so small?
Well, I say to people that we have exactly the number of people to call on to hand count our ballots that we need. And I think that larger counties are in the same position. Larger counties have more people that they could call on to hand count their ballots. They have more resources than we do, so they have more resources they can call on. We have fewer. But, you know, we make it work, and I would think that other counties could do the same.
And why did Columbia County decide to go to a hand counting of the ballots?
In 2010, when New York State was requiring that all counties adopt the optical scanners, my counterpart and I were not comfortable with letting a machine come up with the totals for our elections because neither one of us can really understand how those computers work. We can't look inside them. Even if we could look inside them, we wouldn't have the time to look inside them or the expertise to know what was inside them. And we deploy 33 machines. We couldn't possibly do all that, nor could we employ people that could do that and look at the code, which, as I understand, is not even accessible to us. So what's easy and what works for us, what gives us the transparency that we both need to feel very comfortable about the results that we certified? Taking the ballots, making sure they've been very, very secure from the moment they go to the poll site until the moment they come back to the Board of Elections and get counted and get certified. Taking those ballots, hand counting them with teams of Republicans and Democrats, working very carefully, and coming up with the results based on that. And we feel very comfortable about that.
Commissioner Martin says that the hand-counted results have closely matched the results they've gotten from the machines. And that led some in the public to argue for abandoning hand-counting all the ballots.
But Commissioner Nasky and I said no. Just because that's been the experience, that doesn't mean that there's no vulnerability in the future to glitches or programming errors or even hacking. So we continue to do our audit. Our big, nearly 100% audit.
And one could argue that because you do the audit, you might be less likely to be hacked.
I think that's absolutely the case. It's like an insurance policy for us. Who would want to hack our elections? Certainly any hack would be discovered. And once it was discovered, then maybe, you know, we could determine who did it. It's like an insurance policy. It's not very expensive. Our audit, our big, nearly 100% audit, doesn't cost very much, and it doesn't take very long. We're never late with our results. It's just not that hard to do.
Well, that's really terrific. Virginia Martin, you are the Democratic Commissioner of Elections in Columbia County. Thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Virginia Martin. And go to writersvoice.net for a web-only extra. It's about an innovative app for a citizen's audit of the vote. It'll be tried out for the first time in the upcoming California primary. We'll talk to Daniel Wolf of Democracy Counts. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.